right.
About the photographs from Alaska?
Yeah. I took these pictures. Now I'm wondering what camera I took them with, because my mother had a Kodak Retina, but I don't think it would have taken pictures like that. So I must have had some sort of a plate. I don't know exactly what it was. I can't remember. I mean, I know I used her camera a little bit when I was at Caltech before I got the Leica, which sort of started me on my photographic road. But people when I've had exhibits sometimes, they've asked me, you know, how could I just go out and take, pictures like this, you know, which are without having had any education as a photographer or anything else. And the one thing I've come up with, I don't know whether it's true actually, is that birding, where you learn to, you know, you see something rustling somewhere, and then you somehow have to keep the exact point there in your mind when you lift your binoculars so you actually find it again. Mm-hmm. That's not easy to do. And I find nowadays I'm not as good at it as I used to be. But I think maybe having this ability to sort of get a picture in my mind of what I want to see had something to do with being able to do it in photography. Huh. That's
framing the bird with the binoculars, the lens of the camera.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of, and then, you know, in a lot of my pictures, you know, like this one, you can look at it if you would like to, but a lot of them are of people like this, where often the people are not aware that I'm taking pictures of them, but they are, you know, they are that. And
bring up something I'm interested in, and I hope we could follow up on it later, but to ask now is the way of observing this tradition you have of observing nature from afar that begins with the microscope, moves through the birding, and then even in your career as in molecular dynamics, particularly the simulation work, observing nature and seeing it in process, but not necessarily intervening in that process. Is that something that you're conscious of through time, or is that something that you've... have you thought about your scientific work in that realm?
Well, certainly seeing things, observing them has been very important, whether the question of interacting with people or not. I don't know. I mean, it's true in many of these cases, the idea was to take photographs of people where they were acting normally and actually didn't know that I was taking photographs of them. And I had this Hector lens for my Leica camera, which my uncle brought over it, and I got a sort of a PhD present. And it's a lens... which has a little viewer on it, like, you know, nowadays there's so many cameras which have viewers without actually having a place to actually. And so you could look down at this viewer, and you could say, if I wanted to take a picture of you, I would face like this and hold the camera
away from me.
Looking at the camera, yeah, I would face away and take the picture. In many of the photographs, if you look at them, you'll see that people know I'm doing something, and they often are looking to what I'm taking the picture of, but they don't realize that I'm taking picture of them. I mean, I don't know whether I can find it, but there's one very classic picture in the Southwest. There's sort of, for example, this picture, which is an example. You know, this guy is looking at me. Mm-hmm. He's wondering what I'm doing. Or he's looking in my direction somewhere. I mean, he's not looking at me. He's looking, you know, he has no idea that I'm taking a picture of him.
I did something similar when I was at Cornell.
Now this is also, this is another one where,
where
the guy, you know, is obviously,
I was using a Leica camera. It was manual. And a lot of people were expecting the whir and the buzz of, you know, film winding. And I just sat on a bus, rode around a bus, and just had a camera in my hand, pretended like I was playing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And every so often I would snap a picture. And I actually have one of those pictures hanging in my office because I thought it was just great. It was someone who was looking at the camera but didn't know I was taking a picture. So
no, I've actually done that. And I guess there's somebody who's actually published or a set of pictures taken on the subway.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, where it just would sort of, I mean, he wouldn't, I mean, not all of his pictures would come out because he would have the camera down here, but you learn after a while. I've done it a little bit. What kind of Leica did you have?
I don't even remember which one it was. It was probably a 1960s, 1970s Leica.
And it was film.
Film, yeah, right, completely manual.
It was one of the little, what I had. Yeah. I have it somewhere, but not here, which is, it's a beautiful, I mean, camera.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a 3C, which was, was probably similar to that. It's very light. It makes no noise because it has this cloth shutter.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's great. And then I use this Hector lens a lot for doing this. When I've gotten into trouble, I wanted to submit some of the photographs, portrait photographs, and they asked me, did I have permission? I said, well, they're all dead. Very likely. They wouldn't let me.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess now they're very concerned, and now that I've used a digital camera, it's sort of like if I take a picture, still with the same objective, that they don't know I'm taking the picture, but then I'll show it to them, and then often get them to sign something.
Oh, really?
Anyway, so that's.
Can you tell us a little bit about? We know that your older brother went to Harvard, Robert went to Harvard. Why did you want to go to Harvard, or why did you go to Harvard?
Well, I did go to Harvard, and I don't know, there was just no doubt, really, that I wanted to go to Harvard. You know, it was a local school that was certainly an important part of it, and never considered anything else, never applied anywhere else, and I was somewhat concerned, I suppose, a little bit about getting in, but and there was Robert von Mises, who was a professor here in applied mathematics, I think, and so that my family vaguely knew, and so I went to visit him, and he wrote me a recommendation. But, you know, I did very well. I mean, I always did very well on tests and all these SATs and everything, and so
So you applied to one school, you went to that school.
Right.
Okay.
And then the first semester, I guess I lived at home, and then Harvard gave me a national scholarship with a specific, I had the Westinghouse scholarship. You know, it cost $200 per semester to go to Harvard, which was more, by nowadays, would be more money, but it's nowhere near what it actually costs nowadays. And so the Westinghouse scholarship paid for the tuition. But then they gave me a national scholarship. I don't remember how much it was, but the stipulation was that I would live actually in houses here, which was, you know, I think a very important part of the fact that, you know, because so much goes on outside, and if you have to go home to Newton, you know, every night or whatever, and public transportation isn't so great anyway. It's much worse than now. So I did, and then I moved into Adam's house, which I moved into for two reasons. I guess it was the quote, this is the most intellectual house, and secondly, it had the best food.
Cooking again.
So it just, and food certainly has played a role in my life for a long time.
Did you have a sense of what you wanted to major in the moment that you arrived at Harvard, or were you...
You were still involved in the birding experiences at this time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, right. Relatively little. I mean, that was, I was still with Alaska and such, but, I was still thinking when I came to Harvard that I'd go to medical school. Mm-hmm. But it was really in the first semester, and I had Leonard Nash, who was the first Jewish professor in chemistry, and was a great teacher in the whatever freshman course I took. And again, there was sort of a group of us, Gary Feldenfeld, one whom I sort of continued to interact with for a long time, and Dwight Goodman. Gary became a scientist and went to NIH, and with Goodman to, I think he went into, maybe he actually did go to medical school, but anyway, there was a group of four or five of us where we had sort of a similar interaction with Nash as it had in junior high school. I mean, that we sort of worked together and talked to him afterwards and could explore things in more detail and didn't have to worry so much about the exams and such. So that had a very important effect on me. And I think at that time, I decided, as I mentioned, that I was more interested in learning about the biological systems and actually being a doctor and applying it. Mm-hmm. And that was one part. And then the other part was that I realized, and I think that was sort of unusual, that I realized that really to understand biology, you should really know chemistry and physics, which nowadays I think is obvious to everybody. But so I actually majored in chemistry and physics, which Harvard was one of the few schools to have. My brother had majored in the same area.
He had done that before. Robert had done that before.
Yeah. And another reason, I mean, there are always these sort of good reasons and then, I don't know, not really real reasons, but mixed reasons that if you majored in chemistry and physics, then you didn't have to take analytical chemistry, which I guess was a good course, but it's not one I wanted to take, and I think my brother had also gotten out of it. So that was another benefit of it. There were lots of things that I did when I was at Harvard that were somewhat unusual. Like I majored in chemistry and physics. It was also sort of, in general, a much more open program. You had to take a certain number of courses and a certain number in chemistry and physics, and it was really almost up to you what you took. And so I didn't take elementary organic chemistry, was taught by Louis Fieser, and was, I don't know whether you interviewed him or not, it may have been too early. And, he was a famous course that was taught then, but they had some notes for the course that he had written before he finally wrote a textbook, which was a textbook widely used for many years. And I think I got it from my brother, and I studied that and never took elementary organic. And there was an advanced course. In my view, elementary organic in those days, you had to learn lots and lots of reactions, and there wasn't very much interest to it. And then there was an advanced course taught by Paul Bartlett, which was sort of principles of, I don't remember the exact name, but basically was much more concerned with understanding why reactions happen. And so I took that course without having taken the elementary course. And it was hard for me, not because the material was difficult, but he assumed, well, you know this reaction and you know that reaction. Let's talk about, you know, what happens. And I think it was probably a mistake. I mean, it would have been good for me to really have had this knowledge of organic chemistry, particularly if you go into, you know, trying to understand molecules and biology and such. But I mean, I survived the course, and I think I got an A in it. But that was really, you know, I mean, again, you know, nobody else had ever done this, as far as I know, and so there were a number of I did that, and then I was, you know, was interested in biology, so I took a course by George Wald, which was a very exciting course, and by Kenneth on molecules and biology or something like that. And then
what was it like in class with George Wald?
Well, he was a very exciting lecturer, and you know, I got to know him and his wife Ruth Hubbard, who and actually did undergraduate research mostly with her rather than with him, because she was really, I mean, this discovery that retinal, 11-cis retinal to trans isomerization is basic to vision, was made by them. As you know, I think she was in a way more instrumental because he was a chemist, but until very late in her life, she never was a professor at Harvard. She finally did become one. I think I wrote about, I mean, it was one of these things, but sort of by taking his course, talking. I mean, he was a wonderful lecturer. Not everything he said in retrospect was correct, but that's not really, well, for somebody learning, it's not really necessary. And there are a number of books, I mean, that actually in Bartlett's course, back to that, I first was introduced to The Nature of the Chemical Bond, Pauling's book, which is a very famous book. And that sort of excited me about the idea that, you know, again, it presents chemistry as something you can understand rather than just learning a lot of things by rote or whatever. And another book was by Albert St. Georgi on, I guess that was called Molecules and Life, and he's the one who got the Nobel Prize for discovering that in paprika, vitamin C was, you know, there was a lot of it, and that's how people got their vitamin C in Hungary, where they eat lots of paprika. And I think his book really has not stood the test of time. And then there's Schrödinger's What is Life, which again is, you know, it's a very exciting book. And
that happened, or Schrödinger's lectures on What is Life happened in the late 40s, around 40
years
ago.
Yeah, it was a new book at that time.
And so was that something that at Harvard was passed around as in discussion?
I don't know. I discovered it and I read it, and I heard in an anniversary of Schrödinger's life, Max Perutz, who I also had interaction with, as you'll hear later or something, when I was interested in hemoglobin, I was invited to give a lecture in the symposium, and Max Perutz gave a lecture. And what he said about what his life was, either what was in there was known or it was wrong, which was not a very charming thing to say, but Max Perutz was sort of very didactic and just, and he would say things like that, though he was a very sweet person and wonderful person to know. And also, well, we'll get to that later on when we get to hemoglobin. But like, what I'm trying to say is that a number of these books that really either at the time or later have turned out not to be correct, can present something, a picture of something, in this case biology, as for me that just was very important to me in terms of saying, gee, this is something that one can really do something with. And then I decided that, you know, chemistry and physics would be very important to know. And that was sort of really one of the histories of my development in that area.
So what I'm curious to know is, again, going into college, you were thinking maybe being a physician. And then your thinking starts to change about what it is that you want to pursue and the courses that you want to take. Did you have a sense of what you would be doing with a degree in physics and chemistry? Was there a career that you had in mind when, you know, going into that major? Or did you have a sense of what it is that a scientist, maybe not necessarily an academic scientist, did for a career?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I felt I would want to be a professor. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind.
Okay.
Partly, well, I suppose I was a little bit following my brother's footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I never thought about industry, though I had this one experience, which will come up later, with IBM, which, no, I was just... I don't know whether this is normal for people to. I just knew I wanted to go to Harvard, and I knew I wanted to do research in whatever exactly would develop out of my background and such in biology. I mean, certainly I was very much interested in vision as a result of Walds, and that was one experience. And Tiemann, I guess one of the dreams I had was I had observed plant galls, these little things that plants make, where an insect lays an egg in the plant, and then the plant makes this beautiful egg-like, you can compare it to an egg, essentially, where there's enough nutrient in that, so by the time the grub has grown up, is ready to come out and become a butterfly or moth, he's eaten its way out of this egg. I mean, it really has sort of similar elements. And I was always curious. Now, it may have been actually that my father called my attention to that, and I thought, well, this would be really a great thing to study, you know, how does this, having this grub there, get the plant to make an egg-like structure? I never actually called it that before now talking about it, but it's really, you know, an egg has enough nutrients, so by the time the little bird has eaten its way out, it's ready to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets the plant to do this special thing which doesn't do it any good. And I thought, well, this would be really a nice project to look at, but I never did. Well, I never became really an experimentalist, but it may have been, now that I think back on it, I think it's that my father showed them to me, and they sort of, you can cut them in half, and you can see where how far along things are. And then I read about them, but that was one of the things that sort of, mm-hmm. I thought that was really a great thing to look at.
So you and your brother overlapped for 1 year at Harvard?
Yeah.
And so he was applying to graduate school during that period of time, or had he been accepted already?
He had already been accepted at Harvard, yeah.
Okay.
For graduate, did he stay at Harvard for graduate school?
Let me just make sure I'm saying the correct thing. No, he was already in graduate school at Harvard.
Okay.
When I came in 1947.
So he finished Harvard
undergrad
early.
Yeah, he took only 2 years.
Oh.
Now,
okay.
That's was well, I guess it's no better, if I want to say that, than my finishing in 3 years, because this was after the war, and there the Harvard was teaching three terms a year.
Okay.
So essentially taking 2 years was the equivalent of taking 3 years.
Right.
And
so 6 semesters worth of...
Right, okay. yeah. And so, I mean, he did finish in a shorter time than normal, but it wasn't quite...
Right.
I noticed that you were drawn to these biology professors like George Wald, mm-hmm. Georgie, Nobel-winning professors who were becoming increasingly interested in the chemical dynamics mm-hmm. of life. Was that something that you
maybe
think
the chemistry of life? I wouldn't say that the dynamics wasn't really there. Yeah.
The chemistry of right. life. Was that something that was new to their careers at that point, or was this, as I guess I'm interested in the trajectory of biology becoming increasingly more molecular biology, mm-hmm. in part because of the work that Linus Pauling had, mm-hmm. had been doing, and how these Harvard professors across the other side of the continent were pursuing either similar or maybe responding to some of those interests. So I'm wondering, because it spurred your career, certainly your interests, so I'm wondering if this was a new field for them, if this sort of chemical view of life was happened to just be something that was new and shaping some of the work mm-hmm. happening at Harvard, and you came in at that moment.
Well the answer is, I guess one has to look up what team I'm in. I mean, it was certainly unusual at Harvard. One of the great things about Harvard was that you could take any courses you want. I mean, there were these requirements, but they were pretty minimal. And that the attitude was, well, you take the course. If you didn't have prerequisites, it's your problem if you fail. I mean, that was... And so, you know, all of these courses that I took had prerequisites, which I never took. And but I think I took the courses because I seemed to be interesting, and you know, and interesting from my point of view that they were trying to understand life chemically or whatever. And I think they were unusual at that time. Now, whether in their history this was something new that had my guess is it wasn't that Tiemann had been working on actin and such in plants and how plants adopt different, face the sun and things like that, which people are just now really finding out with that, how it really works. But my guess is he had been, had been sort of a long part of his career and of Wald too. And those, I think are the only courses that I took in biology. But then I took courses in on structure of government taught by somebody named Hartz. I mean, they were known to be outstanding lecturers, and psychology in the mind or something, I think already there were the Confi guide to courses which said, you know, these people are great lecturers, and looked around, and that, so I took probably a dozen courses that were, you know, that had no reason to take, and you didn't have to take general education requirements. I mean, it's much more structured nowadays to force people essentially to go out the fields, and those courses start at an elementary level so that anybody can take them without prerequisite. These were just courses which, if you were in that department, you know, you went through the sequence and then ended up there. But it was really an exciting experience for me to be able to do that, and I think that was one of the important parts of being at Harvard. Yeah, I guess.
I think that might be a good stopping point, unless you have.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.